From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the latest on the Iraq crisis, anger and threats in Ukraine's capital over a ceasefire proposal, passing of an American jazz legend, plus results of the World Cup going on in Brazil. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Here in Washington on Thursday, President Obama spoke to reporters about his latest meeting with the White House National Security Team. They've been meeting quite frequently since the latest advances by the Islamic State in Iraq and the Levant, or the ISL, in northern Iraq. He outlined how the U.S. will continue to respond to the situation there, including sending 300 advisors to Iraq to help the Iraqi government in its fight against the Islamist militants.
First, we are working to secure our embassy and personnel operating inside of Iraq. As president, I have no greater priority than the safety of our men and women serving overseas. So I've taken some steps to relocate some of our embassy personnel, and we've sent reinforcements to better secure our facilities. Second, at my direction, we have significantly increased our intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance assets so that we've got a better picture of what's taking place inside of Iraq. And this will give us a greater understanding of what ISIL is doing, where it's located, and how we might support efforts to counter this threat. Third, the United States will continue to increase our support to Iraqi security forces. We're prepared to create joint operation centers in Baghdad and northern Iraq to share intelligence and coordinate planning to confront the terrorist threat of ISIL. And through our new Counterterrorism Partnership Fund, we're prepared to work with Congress to provide additional equipment. We have had advisors in Iraq through our embassy, and we're prepared to send a small number of additional American military advisors, up to 300, to assess how we can best train, advise, and support Iraqi security forces going forward. American forces will not be returning to combat in Iraq, but we will help Iraqis as they take the fight to terrorists who threaten the Iraqi people, the region, and American interests as well. Fourth, in recent days, we've positioned additional U.S. military assets in the region. Because of our increased intelligence resources, we're developing more information about potential targets associated with ISIL. And going forward, we will be prepared to take targeted and precise military action if and when we determine that the situation on the ground requires it. If we do, I will consult closely with Congress and leaders in Iraq and in the region. I want to emphasize, though, that the best and most effective response to a threat like ISIL will ultimately involve partnerships where local forces, like Iraqis, take the lead. Finally, the United States will lead a diplomatic effort to work with Iraqi leaders and the countries in the region to support stability in Iraq. At my direction, Secretary Kerry will depart this weekend for meetings in the Middle East and Europe, where he'll be able to consult with our allies and partners. And just as all Iraqi's neighbors must respect Iraq's territorial integrity, all of Iraq's neighbors have a vital interest in ensuring that Iraq does not descend into civil war or become a safe haven for terrorists. Above all, Iraqi leaders must rise above their differences and come together around a political plan for Iraq's future. Shia, Sunni, Kurds, all Iraqis must have confidence that they can advance their interests and aspirations through the political process rather than through violence. National unity meetings have to go forward to build consensus across Iraq's different communities. Now that the results of Iraq's recent election has been certified, a new parliament should convene as soon as possible. The formation of a new government will be an opportunity to begin a genuine dialogue and forge a government that represents the legitimate interests of all Iraqis. Now, it's not the place for the United States to choose Iraq's leaders. It is clear, though, that only leaders that can govern with an inclusive agenda are going to be able to truly bring the Iraqi people together and help them through this crisis. Meanwhile, the United States will not pursue military options that support one sect inside of Iraq at the expense of another. There's no military solution inside of Iraq, certainly not one that is led by the United States. But there is an urgent need for an inclusive political process a more capable Iraqi security force, and counterterrorism efforts that deny groups like ISIL a safe haven.
That's President Obama speaking Thursday at the White House. And in Iraq on Thursday, there were conflicting and unconfirmed reports which indicated Iraqi government forces have lost control of large chunks of the town of Beji and its oil refinery, the largest in the country. We get more now from Edward Uranian in the VOA Middle East Bureau.
Amateur video shows a convoy of Sunni ISIL militants honking their vehicles as they enter the oil refinery town of Beji. But it is not clear how much of the town the militants control. Witnesses say black ISIL flags are flying from watchtowers surrounding the refinery. Iraq's Sharqiya TV reported fighting was taking place near the plant's main control room and several oil tanks were on fire. A government security commander claimed to be inside the plant in a phone interview with state-run Al-Iraqiya TV. Several hundred workers were evacuated from the refinery Thursday. Iraqi military spokesman Qasem Mohammed Atta insisted during a news conference that government security forces control all of the Beji refinery. He says more than 70 terrorists were killed as they tried to attack the plant. He adds 17 of their vehicles were destroyed in the battle. Some reports say ISIL militants have entered the town of Bakuba on the Diyala River, 60 kilometers north of the capital. General Atta claimed a number of media organizations were lying about recent events, broadcasting false information to affect the morale of the Iraqi public. Five Iraqi TV stations have reportedly been shut down by the government for alleged infractions. Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki has repeatedly accused Saudi Arabia and other Sunni Arab Gulf states of supporting the growing insurgency. But Saudi Foreign Minister Saud al-Faisal hit back at Mr. Maliki. He says Mr. Maliki should be careful of what he says because he has inflamed the sectarian conflict by encouraging the formation of sectarian militias. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
And you can stay updated on what's happening in Iraq and the international response by going to our website at voanews.com. Still ahead on International Edition, is there any chance of peace in eastern Ukraine anytime soon?
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia, debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays. That's Encounter, every Saturday and Sunday on the Voice of America.
Separatists in eastern Ukraine have rejected the government's offer of a unilateral ceasefire. Angry citizens in the streets of Kiev have often also given the idea of thumbs down. Many in the capital say they didn't stand for days in the bitter cold earlier this year to top the former Russian-friendly president, who for a new president to pander to the Russian aggression. While Petro Poroshenko's peace plan has won the approval of France and Germany, it puts him in the dangerous position of alienating his support base just weeks into office and in a nation with a history of ousting unpopular leaders. VOA's Anita Powell is in Kiev with our report.
No one was surprised when pro-Russian fighters in eastern Ukraine, known for their brutal guerrilla tactics, automatically rejected the new president's offer of a unilateral ceasefire in return for the rebels putting down their arms or leaving the country. Such a deal, President Petro Poroshenko said, would bring an end to the conflict that has ravaged eastern Ukraine since the country's pro-Russian president was toppled in February following violent confrontations between anti-government demonstrators and security forces. but in Ukraine's capital, which has seen peaceful demonstrations nearly every day for the past 3 months. Some of the protesters say they're hopping mad over the prosecution of the military campaign against the separatists and the new president's willingness to lay down arms. As Kiev's new city council prepared to hold its first session Thursday, the top city official was loudly harangued in the foyer by residents over the poor state of preparedness for Ukrainian troops. A group of wives and mothers in Kiev say they want their men brought home immediately because they're outgunned and unprepared.
Не было патронов, чем стрелять. Говорит, мы вторую ночь не переживем, мама, делай что-нибудь. Не переживем.
The woman, clearly upset, says her son told her, "We have no bullets to shoot. We will not survive one more night. Mom, do something." The official, Volodymyr Bondarenko, sympathizes, saying, "It's a crime. I promise I will demand..." But she cuts him off. At this point, a man in the group demands that Bondarenko swear it, promise. The woman, Irina Labun, 53, said she has two sons, Alexander and Dmitry, deployed as soldiers in eastern Ukraine.
Нету прекращения огня. Прекращение огня одностороннее, только с нашей стороны ребята не имеют.
There is no ceasing fire, she says. We have only a ceasefire from one side, our side. Our boys don't have the right to shoot. And the militants, she said, are shooting at them. In the Maidan, the main Kiev square that was the epicenter of February's protests, this man, who gave his name only as Taras, says he thinks a ceasefire is a bad idea. Ukraine's government calls the military campaign against the separatists an anti-terrorist operation and refers to the militants as terrorists. You don't negotiate with terrorists, he says.
I think it's a very bad proposition. Terrorist, with terrorist, don't speak. With terrorist, my mind, with terrorist, don't speak.
Another protester, who gave his name only as Ali, hinted at trouble for Mr. Poroshenko. Ali, with his camouflage uniform, bandit-style headscarf, full beard, and guerrilla superstar sunglasses, is among the legions of Ukrainian self-defense forces in the capital who protected protesters against riot police. If Poroshenko goes against us, he says, we will attack. This cycle of instability and conflict is all too familiar to another Maidan protester, Vladimir, who said he served as a young Soviet soldier in Afghanistan. He says he understands the humanitarian reasons for declaring a ceasefire. But he says his military experience more than two decades ago makes him cynical about a ceasefire. In theory, he says, the president is doing the right thing by the international community and the people. But from a military perspective, we fought in Afghanistan. We know what war is, and we know how it happens. This time will be used for regrouping, and it will be much harder to free this territory. At his inauguration more than a week ago, Mr. Poroshenko promised he would end conflict in the East within a week. Both German Chancellor Angela Merkel and French President François Hollande support the ceasefire idea and have urged Russian President Vladimir Putin to accept the offer. But judging by the reactions of Mr. Poroshenko's base in Kiev, he is now fighting on more than one front, with a brewing political fight over his handling of the conflict. And in a nation where two of the last three leaders have been challenged by serious uprisings, that is a daunting prospect indeed. Anita Powell, VOA News, Kiev.
Also in the news, Kenyan officials say security forces have shot and killed five people suspected of involvement in deadly attacks that killed more than 60 in a coastal town earlier this week. The Kenyan Interior Ministry said the five suspects were killed while escaping in Lamu County, where the attacks took place. It said several guns and some ammunition were recovered at the scene. Earlier in the week, Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta rejected claims that Somali militants were behind the attacks in and around the town of Empeketoni. He said the attacks were well-planned, orchestrated, and politically motivated ethnic violence against the Kenyan community and accused local political networks of involvement. But Somali militant group Al-Shabaab has claimed responsibility for the attacks, which killed some 50 people on Sunday and at least 15 others in a nearby village on Monday. A UN investigator reports about 4,000 Eritreans are fleeing the country every month to escape indefinite national service, arbitrary arrest as well, and other persistent violations of their human rights. Last year, about 2,000 people fled Eritrea every month in search of asylum. That number now has doubled, and Sheila Keetruth calls the 50% spike shocking.
It shows the level of despair. Hope is outside, even if it is very difficult. The route to reach that is very difficult in terms of, you know, death in the desert or drowning at sea. So that's quite shocking. What is shocking also is that people know those risks. And it's like we take it because there is no other choice.
UN Refugee Agency reports 13,000 Eritreans have arrived in Italy by boat since the beginning of the year, accounting that is for 32% of all the arrivals in the European country. What is pushing Eritreans to leave is the pervasive and brutal abuse of their rights, according to Keetruth's report. She says people are fleeing to escape the country's system of national service as well. Originally designed as compulsory military service for a limited period of time, Keetruth says it has been transformed into a system of indefinite forced labor.
Originally, it was meant for 18 months, and at the moment it has become an indefinite situation where people are conscripted for 14, 15, 20 years from the age of 18 up to 50 years indefinite national service. The whole population is conscripted, so it is in fact not a sustainable long-term solution in terms of running the country.
UN investigator cites what she calls guilt by association, as the families of those who flee are punished by having to pay a fine or being detained. She says detention centers are severely overcrowded and are often underground cells or shipping containers, which are extremely hot. She says people receive little food and hygiene is horrific, conditions often leading to death while they are in custody. Nigeria's state oil company says India has overtaken the United States as the biggest importer of Nigerian crude. A statement on Thursday says the U.S. has drastically reduced imports of 250,000 barrels a day. It says India is importing one-third of Nigeria's daily output of 2.5 million barrels, followed closely by China and Malaysia. The U.S. boom in domestic shale oil production is behind the shift.
From the ordinary to the extraordinary, you never know what in the world will happen next.
The world is watching with grave concern as Russia has positioned its
military. You should not allow anyone to deprive you of your right to determine the future.
We are using this against terrorist groups coming from Turkey.
With a landing on
civilians. And sponsored by, no, we are not killing civilians.
With all that's happening, VOA News works to keep you up to date every hour of every day. So when you want to know what's new, you know what to do. Tune in your radio or click on the internet. World News on the hour, every hour, or at your convenience at voanews.com.
Jazz pianist and composer Horace Silver has died. Richard Paul now has a look back on his remarkable career.
Throughout a career that began in the 1940s, pianist, composer, and arranger Horace Silver always had one goal in mind.
I try to make people think with my music.
That's Silver in a long biographical interview from 1981 with jazz writer and photographer Bob Rosenbaum. Speaking recently, Rosenbaum recounted the highlights of Silver's life, which started as the son of an immigrant from Cape Verde.
He grew up in a musical household. They used to throw parties for the family, you know, on Saturday afternoons. People would come over and play the music that they grew up with in the Cape Verde Islands.
Here's one of his best-known compositions, Señor Blues.
While he was successful as a pianist, throughout his career, Silver was most revered as a composer and arranger. His strength was drawing from multiple sources and putting them together in the jazz idiom.
I've always taken a bit of this and a bit of that and blended it together in the beginning, and I still do dig the blues, gospel. I love Latin rhythms. I love Broadway show music, classical music.
Silver began playing in clubs in his hometown of Hartford, Connecticut.
We played for the floor shows. They had a strip dancer, a comedian, and a singer.
While the setting was less than ideal for the straight-laced Silver, Bob Rosenbaum points out the clubs had one key benefit.
They would bring in named players.
One was saxophonist Stan Getz, who sat in with the house band one night in 1950.
He just liked Horace's playing, and he said, would you come on the road with me? And then they were on the road for like half a year.
After Silver got off the road with Getz, he took to rehearsing during the days at New York's famous Birdland Jazz Club, mainly because he didn't have a piano of his own. But being at Birdland put him in touch with all the jazz greats of the time, and it was there, around 1952, that he met drummer Art Blakey and started one of his most important collaborations, the Jazz Messengers.
It was really Horace who created the Jazz Messengers. His presence enabled the establishment of the Jazz Messengers. Had a very, very together, balanced sound. It created a unit of sound which didn't exist before. Actually taking the idea of bebop, which is melodically very exciting and rhythmically very exciting, and adding a front line to it of horn players and making it more of an orchestrated sound.
Working with the Jazz Messengers connected Silver with the legendary jazz label Blue Note Records, which would be his musical home for the next 25 years. But Silver's time at Blue Note ended in disappointment. Silver left the iconic label and struck out on his own. Creating his own record labels, Silver dove headlong into music that made people think. He created a trilogy of experimental compositions with voices and unusual combinations of instruments, and in 1981, he collaborated with Bill Cosby on a record for kids called Guides to Growing Up.
We should try very hard to do our own thing and not follow the way of others. We should always have an intelligent dream in our minds and keep busy and work very hard in order to make our dreams come true. We should think of our dreams as...
I think he felt deep inside that it wasn't just about playing notes and improvising in clubs and making people happy for an evening, but that he really had something to say with his music.
And he wanted those messages, above all, to last.
To try to write music, record it, perform it in such a manner that it will withstand the test of time.
Horace Silver died in New Rochelle, New York. He was 85 years old.
No doubt Horace Silver was a true jazz great. Well, what about the World Cup? Luis Suarez struck twice, including a dramatic late winner to earn Uruguay 2-1 victory over England in Group D match on Thursday. England now left, who lost 2-1 to Italy in the opener, at the bottom of the group, for the most part likely not to reach that final 16. Italy will play Costa Rica in Group D later today. On Thursday, Colombia moved past, closer to reaching the final round of the World Cup in Brazil, with a 2-1 victory over Ivory Coast. And that win lifted Colombia to the lead in Group C. And in Group E later today, it'll be Switzerland up against France, plus Honduras and Ecuador. And you can get more on Twitter at VOA Football and on the internet at voafootball.com. Many thanks, everyone, for joining us here on the Voice of America for International Edition. Hope you'll stay tuned. Latest world news is coming up shortly. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Keith Holmes, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Friday.
This is Today in History. On this day in 1782, Congress adopted the Great Seal of the United States, an official symbol that appears on international treaties and certain government documents. The seal depicts a bald eagle clutching an olive branch and arrows. In 1789, in Versailles, the deputies of the French Third Estate, representing the common people and the lower clergy, met on a tennis court and took an oath demanding a new constitution. It was one of the events leading to the French Revolution. In 1837, Victoria became Queen of the United Kingdom. The 18-year-old queen began the longest reign of any British monarch. In 1863, the breakaway state of West Virginia was admitted to the Union in the midst of the Civil War. Mostly small farmers with no slaves, a majority of Western Virginians opposed Virginia's secession in 1861. On this day in 1900, Chinese nationalists fighting increasing foreign encroachment during the so-called Boxer Rebellion besieged the diplomatic quarter in the capital, Peking. It would take weeks for an international relief force to be assembled and break the siege. On this day in 1919, the German cabinet deadlocked over whether to accept the peace terms presented to its delegation at the Versailles Peace Conference in Paris, France. The Germans, who had been counting on the approval of U.S. President Woodrow Wilson's proposals of a peace without victory, were disillusioned by the harsh treaty that eventually emerged. Germany was asked to lose 13% of its territory and 10% of its population, pay reparations, and accept the blame for the war. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The key suspect in the deadly 2012 attack on the U.S. diplomatic compound in Benghazi, Libya, has been captured by U.S. special forces. Ahmed Abu Qatala will now face the full weight of the U.S. justice system. The arrest of Ahmed Abu Qatala, said U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, is a clear reminder to anyone who seeks to harm the United States that they will be brought to justice. Four Americans were killed on the night of September 11, 2012, when armed assailants attacked the U.S. special mission in Benghazi, Libya. Four American personnel, including Ambassador Christopher Stevens, were killed in the violence. It was the first time since 1979 that a U.S. ambassador was killed in the line of duty. The United States, which captured Qatala unilaterally, continues to work through its embassy in Tripoli with Libya's democratically elected institutions to advance shared interests, including establishing rule of law and stability throughout the country. The United States stood by the Libyan people 3 years ago as they rose up against the tyrant Muammar Gaddafi. The United States continues to support them in their desire to build democratic institutions that will provide them with security, protect their universal rights, and help rebuild their economy. In an official statement, U.S. Secretary of State Kerry said the vision of a peaceful and productive new nation will guide Libya's future, and they have a friend in the United States as they pursue that vision. We will remain vigilant against all acts of terrorism, said President Barack Obama in an official statement. We will also sustain our support for the Libyan people as they work to overcome years of tyranny and do the difficult work of building a democracy.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.